This is Audible.
10-Tor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Running the Light by Sam Talent. Foreword by Kyle Kinane. Narrated by Kyle Kinane, Bert Kreischer, Trey Crowder, Ari Shafir, Mark Maron, Dan Soder, Adam Caton Holland, David Borey, Chris Gethard, Doug Stanhope, Tim Dillon, Jackie Kashian, Tracy Shaley, Greg Shaley, Nathan Lund, John Novosad, Phil Palasol, Nora Lynch, Christine Levine, Rick Kearns, and Emily Talent.
For my mother for teaching me how to read, for my father for teaching me what to read, and for Emily for everything, for always. This book is dedicated to comedians, but only the funny ones. Do you mean to tell me you could have taken your hand out of that cuff at any time? No, not at any time. Only when it was funny. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? For you, the day bison graced your village was the most important day of your life. But for me, it was a Tuesday. M. Bison, Street Fighter. It was all right to be who he was, but others would probably think it was terrible. Dennis Johnson, Angels.
All right, here we go. We're rolling an old Sammy T's Forward. So here we go. Forward by me, Kyle Kinane. I resent Sam Talent. His book was supposed to suck, or at least I wanted it to. Maybe it would just be okay. Okay works. Hell, even good would have been acceptable. You see, I don't mind it when gifted people are decent at other things. In fact, I encourage it. Hobbies are healthy. Isn't that right, Aeronaut Harrison Ford? Dennis Hopper paints. Steve Martin plays the banjo. Professional jet skier Robbie Van Winkle dabbled in music for a while. That joke's funny because that's Vanilla Ice. The thing is, Sam is an outstanding comedian. He's better than 99% of you will ever be. That should be it. That should be his thing. When we tour together, unfairly, I'm the headliner and he's the feature. That means he goes up before me and makes criminally fast work of the aging skateboarders and bestubbled punk flunkies who've been fooled into thinking my gold-plated fart jokes are worth a shit. My name might be on the ticket, but Sam is the person who gives them their money's worth. Crowds watch Sam like a neon Rube Goldberg machine. They don't need to know his what or why to be fully captivated. After he's done, I go on stage for an hour or so and piss directly into the blaze that Sam created. The lopsidedness of talent is palpable, and I collect the lion's share of the door with more than a little guilt. I realize saying the lopsidedness of talent is, Sam's had enough jokes about his last name, but calling a human being lopsided is its own kind of shade you can throw around. Oh, here's the part of the foreword where I went a little out of character and tried to write like a pompous ass. Afterwards, when I'm inevitably drunk back in my suite, the W or something comparable, swirling away another glass of Macallan, I wonder if I can capture just a spark of that fire burning in Sam. Sure, I've got terraced condominium money and the adulation of bloated suburban homebrewers, but where did my passion go? Where does he get this lit fuse enthusiasm night after night? It's in these moments in the hotel when I'm alone and feeling fearless enough to feel vulnerable and blunt that I want to ask him directly. The problem for comedians is that we're always on. The expectation to have a haughty retort to every scenario is exhausting. Any tipping towards sincerity gets quickly brushed away with a punchline, lest we allow our true feelings to cloud the ability to make a dick joke at a funeral. Oh, how I long to have a conversation without some obligation to humor. As I've learned, even sheets with the highest thread count can't keep you company on the road. Money only buys temporary companionship. After I've done my nightwear and drunkenly overtipped whatever regional Latino has come to collect my room service cart, this is when I want to communicate. It's then, in the lonely silence of an unfamiliar hotel room, that I want to open up to Sam, to this talent, hoping that maybe student could so humbly guide the master back to a previous glory. Or at least show me that path back to joy. But by the time I've mustered enough courage to bare my soul to my confidant, he's been down in the rental car, fast asleep. I don't want to wake him. We have another long drive tomorrow. Okay, for real, though. When I first got my copy of this book, I was mad because Sam created something the opposite of stand-up. He sat and wrote a piece of fiction. Stand-ups, even the most disciplined, don't do that. We sleep in rat's nests of chalupa wrappers, every hotel bed a potential coffin lined with fast food. Sometimes we only remember what we had for dinner because we had to look at it again. We treat erections like a budget surplus that needs to be spent now or else the county won't approve the same amount next year. Long-form daredevils trying to jump a Grand Canyon full of heart disease and alimony payments on a nightly basis. Think Bon Jovi's Wanted Dead or Alive, but sung by Carrot Top. Also, we can get to the next town and the next show and get that low-voltage serotonin rush by telling jokes. Stupid magic tricks made out of words. Cheap and easy and instantly gratifying. Stand-up comedy is the corn dogs of creativity. We don't write books. Shit, we barely read books. And we certainly don't write fictional prose, because we can rarely envision a character more exciting than ourselves. Sure, some comics write memoirs, but those are usually terrible. Nobody cares about your parents' divorce, and the most interesting addicts died before they realized they were interesting. So even if this book was bad, it still represented a patience and persistence I was jealous of. Sam wrote a goddamn porterhouse of a book. His prose is slapped down on the page with a demanding fuck you, pay me urgency. Every comic has met a Billy Ray Schaefer somewhere on the road. A former champ still hanging around, outwardly expecting respect, but secretly hoping just for some recognition. Fuck, that's me now. Musty sport-coated cautionary tales, huddled in bathroom stalls, sharing corners of hotel key cards, just trying to keep it going. Isn't this guy a little old to be doing this? Shit, aren't I a little old to be doing this? Sam writes the same way he performs stand-up. No meat left on the bone. He rings out every word for what it's worth. On stage, he doesn't let up on an audience. No gaps. No time to get up and get another drink or take a piss. I can't miss what happens next. This book comes at you the same way. Sam Talent didn't write a book to waste your time. He knows that wasting someone's time is the worst sin there is, because time is something you don't get back.
Chapter 1. Monday. Billy Ray Schaefer stepped off the plane in Amarillo, Texas, with $2,600 tucked down the leg of his black ostrich skin cowboy boot. He walked to baggage claim slowly, jelly-legged and nearing lucidity. Coming out from under the Xanax, he snorted before the flight. He removed his suitcase from the conveyor belt and found a restaurant in the terminal that served alcohol. After three drinks, he went outside and smoked until his ride arrived. The club owner sent his son to carry Billy Ray the 2 hours to Takakamare. The son had a wide pink face that smiled amiably the entire drive. He didn't care if Billy Ray smoked in the truck. Not at all. Just crack the window, please. As he drove, going fast, making short work of Texas, the son, a junior at the University of Albuquerque, remarked on the buildings as they passed. Peeling gray barns, rusted silos, long squat adobe houses baked the color of dried blood. Detailing the different methods of construction and explaining how the architect reflected the evolution of the Southwest as a region and the resilient nature of these humble people. On the barren stretches, he spewed an eclectic barrage of region alfax. Taos Pueblo was built 1,000 years after the death of Christ. Santa Fe is the tallest state capital city. New Mexico is the home to more cows than people and more chili peppers than cows, followed by a list of famous New Mexicans. While the kid prattled, Billy Ray flirted with sleep, barely listening, finding it hard to imagine any life, human or otherwise, being lived in this blast expanse of teeming red desert. Based on how fast he talked, Billy Ray wondered if the kid had any amphetamines. Uppers would be helpful for his continuance. He was reaching the edge of himself. He'd flown a red-eye from Memphis to Dallas, where he suffered a 4-hour layover before switching planes. In Memphis, he performed at a nightclub patronized by black professionals, the men attired sharply in tailored suits, and the women, their elaborate hair in velvet and satin. He was not what they wanted, and they were vocal with their disdain. Before Memphis, he'd done 2 nights in Tupelo at a rat hole called Tortuga's Cantina. Tortuga's, which the locals called Tugs, brought in comedians on the weekends, transforming their dining room into a comedy club with the addition of a stage comprised of a single wooden pallet. The shows were sparsely attended, but the staff prided themselves on entertaining the comedians and, like most service professionals, they were flush with cocaine and generous with their hospitality. Before Tupelo, it was Birmingham and Huntsville and Chattanooga, Tennessee, a riverboat in Knoxville called the Smoky Queen Pearl, and a biker bar in Charlotte that kept a snake in a glass tank behind the bar and fed him on hamsters. 12 days of continuous greyhounds, rental cars, and the cheapest motels starting in Virginia Beach two Wednesdays ago. 12 days of bad food and free liquor and women with low morals. 12 days away from his apartment in Los Angeles, a one-bedroom in Koreatown that was less of an apartment than it was the address of a storage space where he slept on occasion. He'd been on the road for more than 200 days this year. The damage was cumulative, both physical and mental. A sense dulling exhaustion that limited his scope of emotion to a callous and shapeless contempt. He felt like he was evaporating. 7 days to go. They stopped for burgers at a drive-in, where the car hops rode inline skates. The girl who brought their food appeared to be floating, and Billy Ray registered her an angel until he saw her wheels. They ate off the tailgate, watching the clouds push and expand across the West Texas sky. When he was done eating, he lit a Winston, but he couldn't enjoy it. The air was hot enough already. For the rest of the drive, Billy Ray shut his eyes. With no one to talk to, the son whistled to himself, the same 15 notes repeating, and Billy Ray passed gas in protest, filling the cabin with the smell of his decay. When they finally reached Tukukamuri, they stopped at a liquor store, and Billy Ray bought a six-pack of Coors bottles and a small bag of ice. He instructed the kid to deliver him to his hotel where he'd check in and strip nude. After filling a waste paper basket with ice and beer, he laid on the mottled mattress and let the air conditioner lick the sweat off his body. The kid had promised to return at 6:30 to pick him up and take him to the venue. In the downtime, Billy Ray tried to nap, but he was too tired, so he cracked a beer and flipped channels until he found a network playing a show he liked. In the show, film crews followed actual police on patrol, capturing low moments of low people. Domestic violence, DUI, solicitation, assault. The show was his favorite. He found the sincerity of lives in collapse to be absolutely compelling. In one episode, a pair of fat deputies in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, uncovered a kilo of cocaine on a routine traffic stop. Billy Ray watched with envy as the police sliced into the brick to confirm it was drugs. "We just ruined someone's party," joked the cop. When asked, the possessor of the cocaine claimed the kilo was for personal use. "Hell yeah," Billy Ray said as he saluted the man with his beer. The show that night was directly off the highway in a concrete roadhouse named Mingles. A banner hung in the face of the building announced, "Bud Light presents Mingles Monday Night Comedy Riot." Pickup trucks dominated the patch of dirt out front that served as a parking lot. The kid parked away from them behind the building. He insisted on carrying Billy Ray's suitcase. Billy Ray followed him through the back door into the kitchen, alive with smells of potatoes frying in dirty oil, past the lone, harried cook, standing with his hands on his hips in front of one of three microwaves, and continuing through a set of swinging doors into a bar room lit in low red lights, decorated in maroon and black vinyl, outfitted with pool tables, dartboards, and an arcade hunting simulator. "My dad'll be in later," said the son. "Are you hungry? We got your dinner and whatever you want to drink. I've got to set up the chairs." Billy Ray requested a whiskey and coke from a menu from the bartender, a stoic man of deep, wrinkled, indigenous features, his skin clay red, his hair blue-black. He drank his highball fast and ordered another. Nothing about Mingles encouraged mingling. This was an unwelcoming place, vaguely apocalyptic. Everyone looked like a bounty hunter or a gas huffer. They were a grim clientele, all of them unlucky, the sunburnt and scarred survivors of anonymous, intimate catastrophes. They reminded Billy Ray of science fiction, these deep desert mutants of nuclear fallout and Area 51. Looking at them gave him anxiety. He focused on his drinking. By the time the show began, he was quietly very drunk. A few minutes after 8, the son's owner, whose name turned out to be Paulie, stepped out in front of a microphone and introduced the opening act, a tall, thin man defined by an upright shock of stiff white hair. He wore a lab coat and went by the name Dr. Dixon Gorged. For 30 minutes, Dr. Gorged rattled off a combination of joke book jokes and stolen material. Billy Ray identified bits by Hedberg, Carlin, and Cosby among the bad doctor's menagerie, but the crowd didn't notice. If they did, they didn't care, and Dr. Gorged ended his set to decent applause. When the doctor walked past him on his way off the stage, Billy Ray nodded, abiding custom, and offering the traditional obligatory acknowledgement. "Good set." "Thanks. They're fun. Are you headlining?" "I'm up next." The man extended his hand. Wayne Hansen. I'm not actually a doctor. No shit, said Billy Ray. The man's hand was warm and moist. The owner's son was uncomfortable behind the mic. He rocked back and forth. Before we bring up your headliner, I just want to remind y'all, Bud Light drafts are 2-for-1. Wayne Hansen, Dr. Gorge, lowered his eyebrows, smushing his face apologetic. I wish I could stay for your set, but I have to work in 5 hours. That's okay, man, Billy Ray said, clinching his closed bolo tie. I wouldn't watch me either. On stage, the owner's son did his best to bolster the energy in the room, but his false excitement came off as pleading. Are y'all ready for your headliner? He begged, rising a tepid affirmation from the crowd. He talked louder. I said, are y'all ready for your headliner? The crowd responded with slightly more enthusiasm. I've been hanging out with this guy all day, and it has been a hoot. He pulled a slip of paper from his coat pocket and read, you've seen him on Letterman, Leno, Comedy Central, and HBO. Wayne Hansen's eyebrows hiked. You did Letterman? What's the matter? Schaefer sneered. You never seen a big star before? It is my sincerest pleasure to bring him to the stage. Let's give a big Tucum Carey welcome. Here he is, Billy Ray Shatner. Bounding on stage to a wave of gentle applause, Billy Ray Schaefer shook the boy's hand and snatched the microphone from the stand. Keep it going for Paulie and that heartfelt introduction. He looked out at maybe 30 people distributed among 8 circular cocktail tables. When he was setting up the room, Paulie lowered all the lights besides the ones pointed at the stage, rendering the crowd a collection of bodies without faces. Schaefer knew there were more people at the bar beyond his vision. It didn't matter. They did not need to be seen. They all looked the same. He breathed in. He breathed out. Then he addressed the darkness. Tucum Carey, how you doing tonight? Who's drinking? Me too. Cheers. You can't argue with 2-for-1 Bud Lights. Someone's getting a DUI tonight. I heard in Tucum Carey for a sobriety test, the cops make you pronounce the name of this fucking place. Tucum Carey? What the hell kind of name is that? Tucum Carey? Whoever named this town must have been sneezing. Tucum Carey. Excuse me. Jesus Christ. Must be an Indian word. I bet it's Comanche for middle of fucking nowhere. Sounds like the nickname of a very demanding lover. Tucum Carey. She needs it twice? Or not at all. Whatever he lacked in innovation, he made up for in execution, tenacity, and volume. He operated with a defiant nonchalance that concealed his craft beneath a layer of manufactured effortlessness. He'd been doing this, for so long that after a certain indefinable tipping point, he had them. He owned them. And it no longer mattered what words he said, only how he said them. The funny was in the timing, the pronunciation, the spaces in between. He wove in and out of material prepared, riffed at his leisure, and worked the crowd. A lot of Mexican couples I see in here tonight, sir. Is this your wife? How long have you guys been together? Wow, 17 years? Congratulations. Mexicans, y'all have the strongest marriages, and I'll tell you why. Because Latinas are fucking scary. Look at her. She's laughing, but she knows. You ask a white girl for a divorce, she might sue you for an alimony. Worst case scenario, she'll slash your tires. But shit, you ask a Latina for a divorce, she's liable to slash your throat. That's war right there. You know what happens when you ask a Mexican for a divorce? The fucking Alamo is what happens. He was excellent, an emancipator, a prophet, the microphone a relic in his hand. For the duration of his set, he was the only voice in the world. Santeria, cult ritual, jokes as incantation. What he said altered the listener, caused them to revert and devolve. They howled and grunted. They whooped. They squealed. Under his spell, they communicated without words, slapping at each other like lesser hominoids. Some cried. The joy welling up and escaping their eyes in the form of clear liquid and running down their faces, gone sore from smiling prolonged. For 48 minutes, Billy Ray Schaefer harnessed the protean, giving shape to that which has no form. It was a masterful performance that left the crowd liberated and buckling like convulsives. But for Billy Ray, while his attention was occupied, he operated autonomous a sense of pride. While he was killing, Billy Ray Schaefer was completely and hopelessly bored. He checked his watch. He thought about dinner. This task brought him joy no longer. He didn't hear the laughter anymore. Thank you, Tucum Carey. Now let's get destroyed. He stands in the back of the room behind a pool table displaying his merchandise. People approach to pay compliments. Some of them want photos. Others want to talk. He exploits their gratitude for an opportunity to push his wares. T-shirts, beer koozies, CDs. The merchandise is his livelihood. This is how he survives. They thank him for coming and tell him he was amazing. Tell him that they needed that. They hug him goodbye. A few of them ask how he wound up in Tucumcari, a common question in the small towns. He always gives the same answers. I'm just following the money. It's a better thing than to say the truth. Because life is pain and I'm very much alive. He signs the autographs for no extra charge, scribbling in thick black Sharpie, Dave, thanks for the drug money, BRS, or Cindy, thank you for bringing out them titties, girls, BRS. They tell him jokes and he pretends to have not heard them before. He gives them fake laughter. He gives them more of himself. When they offer to buy liquor, he obliges. Beer chases whiskey, tequila, salt, lime. He drinks until he's anesthetized. He asks them for cocaine. Sorry, they say. I can't help you, they say. That's okay, he tells them. I can't help myself. The bar becomes an illusion that requires all of his focus to maintain. He plays songs on the jukebox that make him feel more real. Nobody else knows the words. He orders a cheeseburger, tips the bartender $20, forgets about it, tips him again. Conversations wear on. He begins to repeat himself. There are only so many things to say. Near midnight, a man who claimed to be the owner pulled him away to a small storage room behind the bar. A bare bulb in the ceiling yellowed the chamber visible, illuminating a row of stainless steel kegs lining the walls like torsos of B-movie robots. A water heater hummed in the center of the room, flaking paint. Hanging on the wall, a feed store calendar laid open to a picture of a girl in a bikini lying sideways across bales of hay. She must be itchy, thought Billy Ray. The owner's face was sharp. His sunbaked skin pulled tight, his nose an arrowhead jutting in the middle of his head. The precise angular symmetry of his composition was disrupted by a black patch he wore over his left eye. His long arms hung to his knees, lumpy with muscle, the skin cobwebbed with faded tattoos gone all shades of gray. He looked nothing like his son. "Do you need a check or is cash okay?" said the owner. "Cash is fine," Billy Ray said. "Better for taxes." "I get it." He handed Billy Ray an envelope. "It's like you were never here." The owner pulled out a baggie of white sand from his pocket, held the baggie to the single bulb, flicked it twice with his index finger, and said, "Nightcap?" Billy Ray smiled. "I wouldn't want to be rude." The owner opened the bag and spilled the powder on top of the water heater and carved the mounds into six thin scars with a pocket knife. He licked the blade before closing it, then rolled a $20 bill, tubular, and handed it to Billy Ray. "Fire it up." Billy Ray bent over and snapped his head back with a snort, disappearing two of the lines. The cocaine tightened the parts of him made loose by the alcohol. Immediately, he felt improved. They passed the bill between them, efficient in their consumption. When the first set of lines were gone, the owner chalked six more out. "You got some good shit here," said Billy Ray, licking his lips completely numb. "The guy last week couldn't get enough of it." "Who was here?" "Andrist? Something Andrist? Andy?" "That's it. You know him?" Billy Ray nodded. "Oh, I know him. He's got a Hoover for a nose." "How did he do?" The owner shook his head. "Bad." "Really?" "It was bad. He said something about the military that pissed off a lot of people, and it got pretty ugly from there." "Andy's not for everyone. His stuff's pretty smart. Too smart for this town. They hated him." At last call, Billy Ray stepped onto the patio to smoke and count his money. Including the cash in the envelope, he added $430 to the lump in his boot. The bar emptied, and he watched the last call stragglers stagger across the parking lot, crunching the dirt beneath their soles as they hunted for their rides. He attempted to procure a bit of the owner's cocaine, but they had exhausted his holdings, and now his blood begged for what it couldn't have. As was often the case at this hour, he didn't know what to do. In cities, no matter the night of the week, the party never had to end. But out in the rest of it, in the remote blank nowheres, the night had a way of dying just when it was feeling the most alive. Hard white stars henpecked the sky, burning clearer in the fathomless black. It would be nice, he thought, to spend the night beneath the sky, to lie in the desert and sleep with the snakes. As a young man, when he first began working the road, he spent many nights in a tent camped off the side of the highway. There was an overwhelming sense of adventure in the beginning, a thrilling desperado wanderlust that made each day special and new. He relished every night and the miles in between. Now, after 26 years, the romance was gone. Replaced, as it was, in all long-term relationships with a fatalistic obligation. This is what I do, and I'll do it until I'm dead. Tonight, he'd sleep indoors. His bones were too old for dirt. He was ready to ask Polly for a ride back to the hotel when a girl approached him from across the patio. Her pants hung low on her waist, exposing the points of her hips. an unlit cigarette dangling out of her pinched face. Redheaded and tomboy skinny, her mossy, dull eyes reflected little light. She appeared stagnant behind them, like she was staring out of mud. He recognized her from the audience. She had covered her mouth when she laughed. She asked him for a light, and he gave her his Bic. She asked him what he thought of Tucumcari, and he told her he didn't have a chance to see much. "You're not missing out," she said. She offered to show him some things. An hour later, inside an IHOP bathroom, he had her bent over the baby-changing table, his thighs to her haunches, his fingers in her mouth. She was loud. "Yes, yes," she said. "Yes, yes, 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 yes." She was strong and eager. She pulled him inside of her and held him there. "Yes," he finished on her back. Afterwards, she ordered a waffle with some whipped cream and drank iced tea. They were the only ones in the restaurant, but it took a while for their food to come. While they waited, she told him about her life. It was all very sad. She ate her waffle with a spoon. When she was finished, he paid for her meal, and she drove him to his hotel. "Don't forget about me," she said as he got out of the car. "Never," he told her. He didn't know her name.
Tuesday. Rental car counters were one of the few places where his name still had meaning. Inside of them, he felt special. He never had to wait in line. "As you know, Mr. Schaefer, your membership tier allows you for a free upgrade."
"I'll pass."
"Are you sure? With your rewards points, we could put you in a Mustang at no additional charge."
"I'll take whatever does best on gas."
"Of course, sir. My pleasure." He had no palate for cars. A tool to be used, a conveyance. Their design was of no interest to him. He never understood the appeal. He knew people that owned dozens of cars, motorcycles, boats, all of them insured and in need of routine maintenance, losing their value daily and rusting away like their owners. Things had never been his thing. He spent his money on more immediate gratifications. The day was clear electric blue, cloudless, pristine. The undistilled sunlight bounced off the highway in shimmering waves. It looked like rain in reverse. In a brand new maroon Toyota Corolla, he took the miles of ruined red earth at 90 miles an hour, pressing into the hundreds when he thought it was safe, relishing the speed, challenging the horizon. He stopped at a McDonald's for a large orange juice and married it to a quarter pint of vodka. He sang along to the radio whenever he knew the words. He measured time in mile markers. Albuquerque was 6 exits long. Santa Fe was 3. Once he thought that capital cities received their designation because they were the largest and most prosperous cities in their respective states. Then stand-up dragged him across the country through Springfield, Albany, Carson City, Olympia, and he realized that he did not know much about the choosing of capital cities or about anything much at all. In Raton, he stopped at a diner for pork green chili and fresh tortillas with butter. While he ate, he called his manager, Randy Red Haberstadt, and left another message saying he would call back tomorrow, same time. They had to talk about January, about the cruise ships. He was starting to get nervous. It was important to stay on top of Red, and it had been a few weeks since they'd talked. The submission window for Carnival was approaching, and he needed to know Red had sent in his tape. The boats represented 30 weeks of easy money. He couldn't do another year like this one. He picked up a six-pack of Coors Banquet at a gas station moated by tables of Indian blankets and turquoise jewelry. A dinner plate chunk of quartz caught his eye, and when he stopped to admire it, a shrunken woman with a raisined face approached him from behind the table. "He's beautiful, no?" She wore a rosary. As she talked, she passed the beads between her thumb and forefinger.
"Si," he answered. "Muy bonita."
"Or this." She selected a silver-plated necklace from among her riches and held it up to glitter in the sunlight. "So pretty."
"Authentico?"
"Si. Touch."
"No, gracias."
"Si, si. Tocalo."
"I see it."
"Tocalo."
"Lo siento, mamacita."
"Un regalo para tu amor."
"I have no amor."
He drove on, crossing Raton Pass and the volcanic mesas, pushing spruces and Christmas firs from their rich black soil, passing Fisher's Peak and the sprawling walls of granite left over from the construction of I-25, and the closed exits to the ghost towns created by the interstate when it made the railroads obsolete. 4 hours after leaving Tucumcari, he arrived in Trinidad, Colorado, and found a park near a river to get out and stretch his legs. He removed his boots and socks and locked his bankroll in the trunk and walked down to the water in his bare feet, concealing a beer in his pocket. He'd been slipped a joint the night before, and while he wasn't big on dope, he figured with 4 hours between him and showtime, he had nothing better to do than get a little stoned. Part of the job was killing daylight. Spending too much time in a hotel room gave him a caged, static feeling that reminded him of jail. Boardwalks, movie theaters, shopping malls. In these places, he whittled the excess hours off his days. But given the option, he preferred parks for the lack of crowds and the low price of admission, and because he could loiter and smoke cigarettes and drink liquor from brown bags. In the shade of a scabrous ponderosa, the bark cracked and eaten up with blight, he sat down and lit the joint and sank into the listless afternoon. The smoke was dense and smelled like gasoline and turned the water of the purgatory complex and beautiful. The river seemed alive somehow, sentient, the skin rippling and flashing like melted sunlight. A single-purposed organism built of liquid glass, pulsing and reptilian, like a great blue snake shouldering the banks as it raked its belly along the riverbed. For a while, he became preoccupied in his mind with the pronunciation of the word salamander, repeating it to himself until the syllables lost all meaning. He cracked the beer and drank it, and when it was empty, he set an alarm on his phone and took off his shirt and lay down on his belly, stoned and tranquil and drunker than he expected, enjoying the contrast of the cool grass on his skin and the sunlight on his back. In the quiet of the fading afternoon, Billy Ray dozed off into a restless sleep, finding it difficult without a pillow to find a comfortable position, and dreaming of a pattern of triangles and squares. At 7, the alarm called him back from wherever we go, and he woke up in the darkness, thirsty and confused, unsure for a moment of this place in the world and who he was in it. He drove to the hotel and checked in. Before he took a shower, he masturbated into the sink with the lights off so as not to see himself in the mirror. His reflection ruined the experience. The GPS led him to a nondescript building on the outskirts of town. He pulled up slowly, unsure if he'd entered the correct address. He rolled down his window and asked a woman in the parking lot if there was a comedy show here tonight, and she told him she didn't know. Probably. She wasn't sure what all they had planned this year. He parked on the side of the building and left his merchandise in the car and walked around to the front of the building, a pre-engineered corrugated sheet metal kit shed, bunker-esque and utilitarian and at home in the surrounding high desert. A plywood deck had been built onto the building, and a spotlight attached to the railing painted the valley below in a pale, ephemeral light. Scraped out by a flash flood the year previous, the valley stretched out like a graveyard, a forgotten place, the bleak landscape bristling with tufted sagebrush and knobs of cactus and dried-out bone-white yuccas, the serrated leaves growing as stiff and sharp as ivory knives. Looming at the end of the valley, the Sangre de Cristos guarded the edge of the world, their enormity blacked out by the moon. The building was one big room. A thin galley kitchen ran along one wall, a bar along the other. Between them, 100 or so people sat at collapsible tables in plastic folding chairs. The walls were sheathed in a faux wood paneling that reflected the obnoxious fluorescent light screaming off tubes in the ceiling. Billy Ray went to the bar and asked the man behind the counter if there was comedy here tonight. "I think I heard something about that," the man said.
"Well, do you know who I should talk to? I'm the comic."
"That would be Dan."
"Do you know where he is?"
The man put down his rag and came out from behind the bar. "Let me see," he said, setting off into the crowd. The man walked with a bouncing limp. While he waited, Billy Ray milled about the perimeter reading plaques inscribed with the names of dead men and the dates they were killed. One of the men was named Leslie Faggot, and Billy Ray laughed. "Mr. Schaefer?" Billy Ray turned around to find the barman standing with a squat, severe-looking man. "Mr. Schaefer," said the man, "I'm Dan Guntley. Welcome to our VFW. Dan Guntley's title was Sergeant-at-Arms. A blocky, square-headed, taciturn man, Dan Guntley had served 2 tours in Vietnam, and despite his age, he still appeared capable of violence. His movements were precise and unwasted, and he shook Billy Ray's hand like he was trying to win a contest. "Help yourself to the prime rib," Dan Guntley said, motioning to a table covered in potluck. "You can take a plate with you if you like. We always have too much." He put his hand on the barman's shoulder. "This is Dave. You already met."
Billy Ray moved his extended finger between the two men. Dan and Dave. That's easy.
Excellent. Dave will take care of you. Entertainment starts at 2100 hours. You'll go on at 21 and a half, right after Ploppo. You're scheduled for 40 minutes and we'll do the raffle when you're done.
Did you say Ploppo?
Yes, sir.
Is that a clown?
No, sir.
You never played Ploppo? Asked Dave.
Billy Ray shook his head. The two men exchanged glances. This seemed to please them.
Well, in that case, Dan Guntley said, I won't ruin the surprise.
Billy Ray loaded a plate with macaroni and cheese and green beans with bacon and slices of white bread and a slab of prime rib as big as his face and ladled gravy over the entire mess. The flimsy plate sagged under the weight of his meal. The grease soaked through the paper. He carried his dinner to the bar and asked Dave for a whiskey Coke.
No can do, partner. No liquor. We only got wine, Mike's Hard, and Coors in a can. But we got a shitload of them, and they're as cold as death.
The beef was leathered, overcooked, and under-seasoned, but he ate it all and returned to the buffet for seconds of the macaroni and cheese. He knew comics that said they couldn't eat before they went on, that digestion messed with their show. Billy Ray never had that problem, especially when the food was complimentary. As a rule, he took whatever was free and kept his eye on the rest. The event tonight was a ticketed fundraiser for a charity that worked with military families. He estimated the average age in the room to be 65 years old. The men were loud, their posture impeccable. They tucked their shirts into their starched Wranglers, and they tucked their pant legs into their boots, and they stood bolt straight, clasping their hands behind their backs as they agreed with each other, treading the surface, using many words to say nothing, waiting for their turn to talk. Their wives were quiet, sturdy women, plain without being homely, chapstick, cheap earrings, lacquered but not polished. They wore their hair piled high into stiff meringues above soda can bangs or pulled back into ponytails that stretched their foreheads smooth and pinned their eyebrows incredulous. Like their husbands, they wore jeans along with denim jackets and hooded sweatshirts and souvenir t-shirts purchased on vacation, and they donned their husbands' Carhartts to step outside and smoke Marlboro Lights and gossip about each other's kids. Nearly all of the men and a good portion of the women wore some kind of hat. Ball caps and boonies and beanies and berets and flat caps and patrol caps and camouflage visors, a few cowboy hats, and he even spotted one deerstalker. All of them stuck with buttons and pins and medals and patches, commemorations signaling their ranks, platoons, and battalions, the ships they manned, the aircraft they flew, identifiers of the lives they lived, reminders of what happened to them, brass scars. The only ones among them not wearing hats were seated at the table closest to the bar, a pack of long-haired young men and their dates, forlorn boys with men's faces who quietly drank beers at a steady pace, their blank eyes ringed in sleepless purple. They looked like they were tired of seeing. Billy Ray had never been here before, but observing these people, he understood where he was. He knew them. He'd met them many times. Proud, generous, unremarkable, their faces big and red and tired, these were capital A Americans, the ubiquitous, stalwart, forgotten surplus. They would die here because they were born here, baptized and married in the same church, living the span of their lives within 50 miles of where they'd been pushed screaming into the world. These people populated towns that only existed on maps. Tama, Iowa. Demopolis, Alabama. Wyoming et al. The faceless spaces between destinations. They spent their lives persevering, aware that they were waiting for something, but for what, they didn't know. Billy Ray went outside and smoked a cigarette in the dark. He wanted to find some cocaine. Having some gave him comfort. It was palliative, a ripcord, an escape hatch. If the show was shit, he could always get high afterwards. And if the show went well, why not celebrate with an old friend? That's what he told himself. But if he was being honest, in rehab they said it was important to be honest, he simply enjoyed being high on cocaine. It made him feel good and smart and special. There was nothing else to it. Life is long and it was lonely out here. After retrieving his merchandise from the car, he went inside to find the crowd clearing tables and chairs from the center of the room. Two boys unspread a tarp in the middle of the linoleum floor and smoothed it flat. A grid had been drawn on the tarp to create a matrix of 49 squares. Spray painted along the vertical axis were the letters A, B, C, D, E,
F, and G, and across the horizontal axis, the numbers 1 to 7. The crowd crushed around the tarp, jostling for position and comparing slips of paper until the appearance of a big man from the kitchen dropped the room into reverential silence. The big man's beard hung past the bib of his faded gray overalls. He walked like he thought he was important. He carried a duck under his arm. "Ladies and gentlemen," the MC said into the microphone, "there he is, Mallard Fillmore." The big man walked to the center of the tarp and raised the duck above his head, an act of ceremony Billy Ray, completely confused, interpreted as sacrificial. The duck, an old mallard with a proud brown bosom, snapped at the man's wrist, drawing blood. The big man cursed and dropped the duck fluttering to the tarp. Billy Ray had never seen a duck indoors, and this was a haggard specimen. Patches of dimpled skin showed through where its feathers had fallen out. The eyes trapped in its teal head indicated neither excitement or petulance, only indifference. Blinking flatly with a hostile stultification, a look of imminent degradation. Billy Ray knew it well. "All right, motherfuckers, let's get this over with. I could be flying right now." "Here we go," said the man on the stage. "Who's ready to make some money?" The crowd cheered. "All right, y'all, it's that time. 1, 2, 3, Ploppo!" The crowd flared like a flame licked by wind. They stomped their feet and clapped their hands and slapped at the flat parts of themselves with their palms or barked or blew sharply into elaborate handheld devices that bleated like waterfowl and looked like kazoos. Others cooed sweetly, throwing bits of bread or kneeling with crackers in their outstretched hands in an attempt to influence its movements, to draw it closer to them and away from the others, whispering, pleading. The surreality was spellbinding. Billy Ray watched like a man on drugs. The MC's voice through the loudspeaker was barely audible over the chaos. "Where will he shit? Where will he blow? Whose luck will hit? We all want to know." "Jesus fucking Christ," Billy Ray said, ascertaining finally the rules of the game. "Grace, do you remember me? I remember you. Duck shit bingo. I'm following duck shit bingo. Condemnation has many names." The crowd's collective fervor crescendoed when the duck waddled absently off the edge of the tarp and sat down to pick at a piece of bread. The onlookers whooped and howled and threw pieces of dinner rolls, but the duck, nonplussed, stared on intransigent, defying their demands. Billy Ray wondered why the bird didn't fly away. For some reason, he thought he remembered hearing that ducks couldn't fly unless they were near water, but that didn't make sense. Did the big bastard clip your wings, little duck? Did you forget how to use them? Cutting through the crowd, the big man went to tow the duck back towards the center, but the duck took his bread and scurried farther down the tarp. Billy Ray smiled. Despite his embarrassment at being involved in this sideshow, he found himself rooting for the bird. In a strange way, he empathized. "Good for you," he thought, watching the duck avoid the big man's boot. "You don't have to feed the pigs their slop, little duck. I do, but you don't." Eventually, the big man got his hands on the bird and walked it back to the free space and said something Billy Ray couldn't hear, and the crowd laughed. When the duck finally shat, the crowd erupted. The watery green mess on space D4 won 2 ticket holders $100 apiece paid by the big man, who then tucked the duck back under his arm and waved to the crowd. He turned in each direction, bowing like a bullfighter, and the strange duo left to a round of hearty applause, and the tarp was removed and the tables returned. Billy Ray checked his watch. Almost showtime. He wondered what the duck was getting paid. Billy Ray went to the bathroom and stepped into a stall to piss. He was glad to be away from the people in the main room. Bathroom stalls were one of the few places he could be himself. They made him think about cocaine. Not including the toilet, he counted 5 surfaces in the stall on which one could measure themselves a serving of powder and snort it in private and not have to share. How fine that would be. Surely someone here had cocaine. He decided that after the show, he would talk to the sullen long hairs by the bar. They looked like they spent time in the bathroom. If they didn't have cocaine, he would take whatever they had. He just needed something, anything, to help him get closer to right. He shook off and zipped himself and stood at the sink trying to make sense of the face in the mirror. When he was younger, he knew he was handsome because women told him so. There was a time in his life when he had been fawned over, coveted. He remembered that face and the permissions it gave him, the strength in his jaw, the devil in his eyes. There was none of that left. He didn't recognize himself. In the 80s, before his wife, he dated a girl who practiced Bikram yoga. On her birthday, he surprised her with a trip to Las Vegas to attend a weekend retreat and see the famous yogi speak. The night of the yogi's lecture, the girl convinced Billy Ray to accompany her in eating LSD. Under the influence of the drug, the yogi's lecture became a sermon of profound revelation. At one point, after hearing the yogi's stance on memory, Billy Ray shouted, "Hallelujah!" and dropped to his knees and buried his face in the carpet. No one remembers what they looked like yesterday, a week ago, last year. There is a version of us inside of our minds that does not correspond to our actuality, an idea of who we are that is unaffected by time or reality. Then one day, you are confronted by the person you really are, the you you have become, the one who exists in the world, the one that breathes and shits and screams, and you realize the people we think we are may never have existed. You were an idea, steam or smoke or wax. You destroyed the man you remember, and in his place is you. You have become a stranger to yourself. You have become an imposter in your own skin. The man, this man, a living thing of blood and bone, here he is. I am him, but he is not me. I will never be the same because there is no future, there is no past. Some men are only here and now, and that's all they will ever be. The yogi's words stuck in Billy Ray like arrows. They became a mantra of supreme importance. He carried them with him like a precious compass until one day he forgot. He splashed cold water on the face in the mirror, watched the water drip. He breathed deep. God damn it, he thought. I need some fucking coke. He left the bathroom to find the hall quiet, the audience seated and listening as a frail woman on stage spoke in a breathless whisper, the words coming in weak gasps, sounding hollowed out. Her clothes hung off her shrunken frame like rags from a leper. Clutching the podium with her thin fingers, bent and emaciated and completely bald, the skin of her head paled to translucence. She looked like a mantis, a Jovian, a mistake of science escaped from a bunker. Above all else, she looked anything but funny. "Over 2,000 new cases of breast cancer are diagnosed every month." "What the fuck is this?" said Billy Ray, turning the heads of nearby tables. He scanned the room for Dan Guntley and located him at the bar. "On the day they found my cancer, I was getting ready to welcome my first granddaughter into the world. I still remember how my son cried when I told him."
"No way," he grumbled, quick stepping to Guntley. "Dan, hey, Dan," he said to the fire hydrant shaped man. "I thought I was on after the duck."
Dan Guntley nodded as he tipped up a silver flask. Whatever was inside made his face lemon. "Yes, sir, that was the original plan, but then Sheila asked if she could say a few words about her charity, so I told her why not. She won't be on long." Billy Ray looked at Sheila, barely visible behind the podium, her wrists the same circumference as the microphone stand and the tiny bones of her skull visible under the harsh white light. She looked like she was stuffed with straw, like a scarecrow, neither dead or alive.
"But at this point, the doctors say that every day I live is a medical miracle."
"Is that all right?" Guntley said, shaking the flask. "Cuddy?"
Billy Ray tipped back the whiskey, filling his throat with iced heat. Dave slid another Coors his way.
"Well, you know," he said, "I guess she's not the worst opener I ever had. I did a weekend with Gallagher once."
"Which is why I set up this charity. I wasn't going to let terminal cancer stop me from riding my horse, and neither should anyone else."
"She's almost done," Dan Guntley said.
"I'll say," said Dave, and the three men laughed.
"Cancer may have won the war, but if I have to die, I'm going down on my horse."
Billy Ray winced. "There's a better way to say that."
He took another sip off the flask. Sheila left the stage with the aid of her husband. Before he led her off, he stepped to the microphone to say that his wife was his hero and that he loved her. And the room welled and then burst with the compulsory applause due to a man and his dying wife. The MC came to the podium, wiping tears off his cheeks.
"Brave words from a brave woman. We're going to miss you, baby. We're all going to miss you very much."
He struggled to compose himself as the crowd dabbed its eyes.
"May God bless you, Sheila." Tell him to take mercy on us. We're giving him an angel.
He honked his nose loudly into a red bandana and wiped his eyes.
All right, enough bawling, y'all. Who's ready to laugh?
No one, thought Billy Ray. No group of people had ever been less prepared to laugh in the history of laughter, organized or otherwise. Drowning a puppy would have been a better opener. Once, in the Florida Keys, he had worked with a Catskill fossil on a string of awful shows. Whenever one of his jokes didn't hit, the fossil would say, "Oy vey, the food lines at that chow were warmer than this." Billy Ray chuckled, "Oy vey, fuck my ass." It was so unfunny, he couldn't help but laugh. As the MC read his introduction, he stood by the side of the stage awaiting the sound of his name, focusing on afterwards, doing the math in his head of how much cocaine he could buy, happy to know none of this mattered and that it would soon be over. In an hour, he would be no one again.
"We feed him on watermelon all day until he can't help but shit himself."
Billy Ray sat at the long bar afterwards, listening to Mallard Fillmore's owner explain the finer points of Ploppo as bow-legged veterans broke down tables and folded up chairs. The crowd vacated. Both Billy Ray and the man were waiting to get paid.
"We sell raffle tickets and guarantee a $100 prize, but we always sell more than 100 tickets and we sell them for $5 apiece, so there's always plenty of cream to scrape. And that's all tax-free on top of the guarantee."
The man breathed in heavy, wet rattles, sharp and raspy inhales, croaking exhalations. His face was porcine and round, his hair brush-cut short into a precise gray diamond. The breast, draped over his massive gut, jiggled whenever he laughed or coughed on the Pall Malls he burned. He smoked them down until they singed his fingers, and through his fat lips he sipped red wine mixed with Pepsi over ice through a straw. Calle Ocho, he called it.
They let kids drink it in Spain.
He said his name is Clarence Wade, as if Billy Ray gave a hot shit, but everyone calls him Junior.
"Popo's the easiest money I ever made, and I know easy money."
Clarence slash Junior rolled his fat cheek up in a wink and grinned, revealing a mouth of purple-stained teeth, each of them dead or dying.
"Only thing better than easy money is easy women."
Billy Ray wondered from what movie the fat man stole this line, maybe an old comic book. Billy Ray believed firmly that beyond the age of 13, there are no original ideas. People talk like the things they see. After a certain age, nothing is new besides death. Billy Ray, hungry for more of the cocaine the fat man shared with him after he got off stage, bit his tongue and decided to fit in.
"Well, any woman is easy if you have enough money," he said. The fat man bobbed with agreeable laughter. "Shit, I'll drink to that."
Clarence slash Junior emptied his tumbler of Cabernet and Cola. His lips were the color of hematoma. Like most Americans, Clarence slash Junior enjoyed talking and disliked listening. The conversation was gapless. He talked fast, desperately unspooling his yarn, leaving himself nothing to weave. This was common. Americans thought they had a right to be heard. They viewed themselves important and integral and interesting. But after talking to as many of them as he had, Billy Ray knew the opposite to be true. In his experience, most people had, on average, one good anecdote and one good joke. That's it. Two things to say, and they repeated them whenever they had a pair of fresh ears. Oftentimes, the anecdote wasn't even their own. 300 million people with 600 million lines of dialogue, and Billy Ray Schaefer had heard most of the jokes. It was a shame. If only they knew what it was that made them unique. Then Billy Ray would never be bored. Billy Ray had many failings, but he used his ears better than most. He learned to hear what was said at an early age. To make his father repeat himself was cause for a beating. He didn't mind listening because he didn't like talking all that much. At his core, he was just one more person with nothing to say. Attention is manipulative. It made men trust him, seeing in the undisturbed pools of his silence a reflection of themselves. Women adored him for it. He inhaled their words like perfume, and they rewarded his regard with their bodies. Listening is foreplay. Heed for head. He knew to be heard as an intimate act, to penetrate, to receive. Commanding a person's attention is to temporarily own their reality. Thus, sociopaths and narcissists coveted his company. He did very well at Hollywood parties. Before he was no longer welcome at such events, he always left with a pocket full of business cards. Clarence slash Junior snorted his sinuses clear, swallowed loudly, and lit another cigarette. Billy Ray found the fat man repugnant. He wondered how he was still alive. Initially, he was only interested in his drugs, but after talking with him, hearing the contentment in the pig man's voice and the lack of spite in his words, Billy Ray was curious how much cash Clarence Slash Jr. pulled in with his rolling waterfowl shit fiasco. The number must have been higher than Billy Ray's quotient. The question was, by how much? Men are measured by their portion of the gate. Clarence Slash Jr. was a shark-eyed carny with a diuretic duck, and Billy Ray was the only white man to ever receive a standing ovation at the Apollo. He needed to know how far he'd fallen. Only then would he know exactly how small to feel. "You sell a lot of merch tonight?" inquired Clarence Slash Jr. "Fucking carny," thought Billy Ray. Carnies lived to talk merch. The fleecing was worth more than the money. The only difference between a carny and a gypsy is superstition and scars. Billy Ray was not a carny. He took no pride in the amount of product he moved. Selling merchandise post-show was a concession of his integrity. Once, in a moment of rare honesty, Billy Ray had confessed to his wife, "I'm not an artist. I'm just a traveling t-shirt salesman that dabbles in spoken word." The duck man was only setting himself up to brag. They had shared a merch table in the back of the room, and Billy Ray had done fine. No records broken. 7 CDs, 5 or so shirts. But his sales were meager compared to Clarence Slash Jr.'s. The fat man sold hats and t-shirts emblazoned with a cartoon duck, its face puckered up and straining as it squats over the phrase, "This duck shits money," and pictures of Mallard Fillmore signed by a webbed footprint stamped onto each glossy 8x10. He charged $20 for one photo or 3 for 40. At one point during the frenzy, Clarence Slash Jr. turned to ask Billy Ray for change for 100. As Billy Ray counted him out 5 20s, the fat man said, without irony, "You gotta love showbiz," and winked his slow, dough-rising wink. It was at that moment that Billy Ray decided he hated him. If it weren't for the cocaine, they would have had nothing to talk about. Billy Ray tried to strike up a conversation with the aged young metalheads in the back of the room, but they didn't bite when he mentioned an after party. Most likely, Billy Ray decided, either because they preferred downers, the black pupils in their blown glass eyes were barely visible through the slits of their nodding eyelids, or maybe, Billy Ray considered, they didn't want to party with a 52-year-old drifter who said things like, "My friend Andrew Jackson is looking for some action." Whichever it was, the youth scolded him, and now Clarence Slash Jr. was his only option if he wanted to hurt less. "I did all right for a bunch of farmers," Billy Ray said, tabulating numbers in his head. He sold around $150 worth of merchandise. "These people were wound so tight they shit corkscrews. I was glad to get anything off of them." "Yeah, I moved about 600, Clarence Slash Jr. croaked. "You vulgar, carny bastard," thought Billy Ray, his hand tightening reflexively around his Coors. He wanted to break the bottle and cut out the fat man's tongue and shove it up his ass, learn him some couth. Instead, he said, "What's the duck's cut?" The fat man smiled. "I just put it on his bill." "Hilarious," Billy Ray said. He finished his beer and reached behind the bar for another. From outside came Dan Guntley, bringing the cold behind. "Gentlemen," he said, approaching with 2 envelopes in his hand, his gait rigid and rehearsed and ex-military, "I apologize for the wait." Billy Ray stood and leaned against the bar next to Clarence Slash Jr. He knew the fat man would verify the amount on his check. Carnies always count the money, the tactless savages. Sure enough, he tore into his envelope as soon as Dan Guntley delivered it, his short arms working on the shelf of his belly like an otter prying a clam. $300, 50 more than Billy Ray's 2.5. Within him, the difference ignited a rage far beyond jealousy, an ignoble scarlet fury bordering homicidal. The inequity demanded retribution. He envisioned a fantasy in which he drove to Los Angeles, killed his manager, and then himself. At the very least, this necessitated a long, serious conversation. He was better than this, even now, even him. Dan Guntley shook their hands and told them they were locking up the building in 20 minutes. He thanked them, and they thanked him, and as soon as he turned his back, Billy Ray leaned over the bar and pulled a 6-pack from the cooler. Clarence Slash Jr. tapped his nose with his index finger. "One more for the road." Billy Ray stood up. "Is the Pope a pedophile?" Freshly cleaned, the bathroom was immaculate. It burned with harsh fluorescence, white light singing to white tile. The walls of the stalls were devoid of graffiti. The toilet sparkled with the luster of wedding china. It reminded Billy Ray of an emergency room or a rest stop, somewhere bad things transpire outside the purview of darkness. The sterility made Billy Ray anxious on top of his indignity. The pronounced cleanliness reinforced the depravity of their actions. They entered separate cubicles. The fat man snorted twice, sounding like an animal at a trough.
"Incoming," the man said, his pudgy hand reaching a paper parcel of cocaine over the top of the stall.
Billy Ray opened it and dolloped a lump onto the knuckle of his thumb and shoved it up his nose, filling his head with warm euphoria.
"That's better."
He took another blast. Too much. Gagged, choking on the drip and retching like a house cat. Clarence Slash Jr. laughed. "I told you it was good." Billy Ray worked Key West, Houston, El Paso. He knew great blow. He'd been unlucky that way. Quality coke smelled like permanent markers and flaked like fish scales and provided enough ego to rip God from the sky. It wasn't gray and it didn't crumble or taste like licked battery. The fat man's cocaine was not good cocaine, but there was a lot of it, and that was good enough. Clarence Slash Jr. snorted loudly and spat a hefty wad into his toilet. "Help yourself to that. I think I'll take a shit."
"Of course you will," thought Billy Ray. "Of course you fucking will."
Billy Ray heard an unclasping, then Clarence Slash Jr.'s coveralls landing in a pile at his feet. The porcelain creaked beneath the fat man as he sat. He grunted, grunted again, then there was a thick, wet sound, like a bowl of chili spilled into a bathtub. Billy Ray threw up in his mouth. Bent in half, his face hovering inches from the toilet seat, Billy Ray wondered if he had ever detested another living soul as much as he despised the fat man in this moment.
"Oh boy," the carny giggled. "I shouldn't have had all that clam chowder."
No, no, he hadn't. This was the capacity of his abhorrence. He had to get out of here. Eureka. Fleeting clarity. He remembered where he was, who he was. He pondered for a moment. No. Go. Fuck it. Of course. He smiled sincerely for the first time all day. Billy Ray unlatched the stall.
"Hey, Clarence, I'm going to meet you outside."
"What's the matter? You don't want to stay for the fireworks?"
"Sounds like the duck could be out of a job."
"Yeah, this might take a while."
"I hope you die like Elvis."
After folding the paper carefully, he tucked the fat man's bundle into his breast pocket and hurried out of the bathroom. The building was cavernous now, empty besides two men in the far corner folding a flag with undue ceremony. Careful not to disturb them, Billy Ray gathered his belongings, tucked the six-pack under his arm, and heel-toed into the night. In the parking lot, only a few cars remained, among them his Corolla and Clarence Slash Jr.'s truck, a lifted and chromed monstrosity glistening with ostentation in the weak gray moonlight. In the flatbed, Mallard Fillmore sat patiently in his cage, its breath clouding in the thin air, its eyes glowing like the truck's hubcaps, vivid green and oddly human. "Oh, duck," he thought. He knew the next move. Billy Ray moved quickly. He loaded his gear into the car, ears scanning the stark night for the sound of footsteps. At any moment, he expected the fat man to appear huffing and slobbering.